Support for this podcast comes from the UTSA Institute of Texan Cultures, telling stories of Texas history and heritage from diverse cultures that define the state's unique character for over 50 years. Details at texancultures.utsa.edu.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. There are riots in the streets. The U.S. military is called out to tear gas American citizens. 100,000 are dead from a botched response to a pandemic. Millions are out of work. Unemployment is shooting up. America's standing in the world is in decline. It's hard to argue that Donald Trump has made America great again. But what happens next? Conservative writer David Frum has written the book Trumpocalypse, He's Restoring American Democracy. He joins us now. David Frum, welcome to The Source.
Thank you so much.
Tell me about the title. I know people think automatically about apocalypse, and they have an impression of what apocalypse is, but you meant something different.
We use the word apocalypse to mean something cataclysmic, zombie apocalypse, murder hoarder apocalypse. But literally, and in our religious traditions, the word apocalypse means a revelation. It comes from two Greek words that mean literally to unveil, to remove a piece of cloth. An apocalypse is a glimpse of the future. And in the prophetic traditions of the ancient Jews and the ancient Christians, the glimpse of the future was a future where one world ended and a new heaven and a new earth came into being. So the Trumpocalypse I'm writing about is it's a vision. It's a description of what is possible and of how one political moment is coming to an end and a new political moment is being born.
So you're having a revelation about what America could be, but there's still that vision of the word that people are familiar with, apocalypse and the doom and gloom, and that does also seem to kind of work for you.
There certainly is enough doom and gloom. My youngest daughter graduated from high school this year, and because they couldn't have a proper ceremony, the girls organized a car parade to go from girl to girl, and an aggressive driver cut off the parade just as it was departing our house, and really mean. And my older daughter was watching and said, "Dude, where are you going? It's Sunday in Washington D.C. during a pandemic, during a race war. What could possibly be waiting for you on the other end?"
So our phone lines are open. The number is 833-TPR-TALK, 833-877-8255. You could also email us at thesource@tpr.org, tweet at us at @TPRSource. Now, as we have this conversation, as we talk about your latest book, David, I want to acknowledge that there are traps that we could fall into, and we have to be mindful of that, where we could just spend the whole hour just bagging on Donald Trump and talking about all the things that he's done that's been awful, people see as awful. But I don't think that's very constructive. And that's not where I don't think you want to do either. You want to move towards solutions, right? But I also want callers to know that if you think we're being unfair to President Trump or to anything else, call us on it. Call in right now, 833-TPR-TALK, 833-877-8255. You will have a full and fair hearing to express your views and to call us on anything you think is not fair. So, David Frum, how do we avoid those traps?
Well, I believed even last year that President Trump was probably going to lose re-election. Since the pandemic, since the economic disasters, since the terrible episodes in our cities, I think his condition becomes even more certain that he is likely to leave office. So what happens then? I've written two books now with the Trump presidency, both with tongue twister titles. The first was Trumpocracy, the second is Trumpocalypse. And they're always trying to be about more than just the personality of Donald Trump. They're trying to say, where did he come from? The first book studied, where did he come from? How did he get power? How did he use it? This book offers an assessment of how he has used power and how we can address the social divides in America that have been such an important resource to Donald Trump. Social divides between country and city, social divides between the better educated and the less educated, social divides between men and women. We now have a huge gender gap in American politics, in part because physically, literally, American men and women have never been less likely to live together. And an absolute majority of people under 30 live without a partner of the opposite sex. So I talk about those possibilities. I talk also about some of the looming dangers to the American future, the problems of climate change, the loss of American global leadership, drug abuse. How do we meaningfully address those things? And I try to offer concrete, practical solutions.
Let's talk about your background a little bit here for people who aren't familiar with your incredible background. You are a staunch conservative.
Yeah, I knocked on doors for Ronald Reagan in the election of 1980. I lived my adult life in the conservative world in the Republican Party. I served in the administration of George W. Bush. As a speechwriter, I was in the White House on 9/11. You know, people wear those sweatshirts that say these colors don't run, but I was in the White House that day, and I'm sorry to admit, we ran. We were driven out into the street by a terror attack. And I worked at the American, every conservative news organization and a number of think tanks. But what I've, over the past 15 years, I've become increasingly concerned that without denying or gainsaying my values, that we were offering a message that just was not relevant to the country as it is today. And a lot of what of the conservatism I knew was offering to do encore performances of the greatest hits of the past. You want the Soviet Union beaten, you want inflation quelled, we knew how to do that. Problem was the Soviet Union was beaten and inflation was quelled. Now what? Donald Trump saw that too, by the way. And this is one of the things I gave him credit for in my first book, that he understood how obsolete a lot of the old conservative message was. You know, that going into 2016, Republican voters are saying, we're worried about immigration, we're worried about health care, and we've had enough of the Bush family. And the Republican Party said, right, we're going to give you more immigration, less health care, and one more member of the Bush family. Well, obviously that didn't work. And Donald Trump stepped into that gap.
Now, people see you as a fake conservative. Some says you don't stand by Donald Trump.
I think people can say what they want. I'm not gonna worry about that. But what I am going to say is, it is strange that you think you have a set of political principles, and it turns out you just have a loyalty to a person. And look, loyalty to a person is a very good attribute in a pet dog, but in a thinking human being, in a world in which people come and go, your loyalty should be to something bigger than any individual human being.
But what is the future of conservatism? We have about an hour in this segment, but we have a minute in this segment, but we have the rest of the hour to talk about that as well. But give us a real quick taste of what does conservatism mean?
Look, the conservatism of the future has to be about the problems of the future. We don't live in 1980. Donald Trump would like us to live in 1968. But we just don't. We live now, and we need answers for now.
All right, we're talking to David Frum. He's a staff writer for The Atlantic, and he is the author of Trumpocalypse, Restoring American Democracy. You can call in with your questions and comments as we talk about what Donald Trump has done so far in his tenure as president. What is he facing as he goes for re-election? What could happen on election day and the day up into inauguration? You know, if he doesn't win re-election, what could he do in that month that would be there, a month and a half? And what do you want to see happening with the response to Donald Trump today? Call in. The number is 833-TPR-TALK, 833-877-8255. You could also email us at thesource@tpr.org. We'll be right back.
Dr. Fauci said earlier this week that the lag in testing was, in fact, a failing. Do you take responsibility for that? And when can you guarantee that every single American who needs a test will be able to have a test? What's the date of that?
Yeah, no, I don't take responsibility at all, because we were given a set of circumstances, and we were given rules, regulations, and specifications from a different time. Wasn't meant for this kind of an event with the kind of numbers that we're talking about. And what we've done is redesigned it very quickly with the help of the people behind me. And we're now in very, very strong shape. I think we'll be announcing, as I said, Sunday night. And this will start very quickly. And we'll have the ability to do in the millions over a very, very quick period of time. So, no, and what we have done, and we are going to be leaving a very indelible print for the future in case something like this happens again. But it was a, and that's not the fault of anybody, and frankly, the old system worked very well for smaller numbers, much smaller numbers, but not for these kind of numbers.
All right, so that was President Trump saying that he does not take responsibility for the response to the spread of coronavirus in the United States. And you mentioned this in your book, David Frum. David Frum's book is Trumpocalypse, Restoring American Democracy. Why did you find that this was a particularly noteworthy exchange?
Well, the phrase, I don't take responsibility at all, will probably enter the history books as the defining phrase of the Trump presidency. It applies to so many areas. Donald Trump has avoided responsibility through his life and through his presidency. You know, one of the points I stress in the book is if you look at the economic trajectory of the first three Trump years, 2017, 2018, 2019, it's basically identical with the last three Obama years. Trump did not increase the rate of job growth. He didn't increase the rate of total economic growth. He didn't increase the rate of growth in manufacturing. All the things he said he didn't do. Just like his family fortune, he inherited it. Then came the coronavirus. And that's not exactly his fault, even if he mishandled it. But as I said, you know the story of the rooster who took credit for the sunrise. Well, Donald Trump is the rooster who took credit for the sunrise. And then the sun set. And the rooster says, why is everyone blaming me? Well, I'm sorry, it's just as arbitrary on both ends. But because he could never take responsibility for anything, he could also never develop that connection with the American people. And that's why his presidency was in trouble even before the virus struck. Donald Trump is the least popular first-term president, even before coronavirus, the least popular first-term president in the history of polling. He never once reached 50% in any credible opinion poll. That's not been true of any president in the history of polling. They all got, in their first term, got over 50% or more at some point or another, every one of them, except Donald Trump. So how is he president? Because he got 46% of the vote. That's less than Mitt Romney got. That's less than John Kerry got. That's less than Al Gore got. The American political system is becoming ever less representative. And so I talk in Trumpocalypse about why this is a problem and how we can address it, how we can practically address it.
The number is 833-TPR-TALK, 833-877-8255. You got a question or a comment for David Frum, staff writer at The Atlantic, very deep roots in the conservative movement in the United States and in Republican politics. 833-877-8255. We're going to have a voicemail. Let's give it a listen.
Mr. Frum, I want to know, do you think it is possible that he can be reelected? If he is, many say this is the end of our democracy. I hope not to believe that. What do you think? What will he go to? What extremes to continue trying to separate this country?
All right, David Frum.
Well, I think before the coronavirus, it certainly was possible that Donald Trump could have been reelected. I think the balance of probabilities was that he was not going to be. I won't take your time now to explain why I thought that then, because that was then. I think now it would be exceedingly difficult. And here, let me just give you one point. The best predictor of whether presidents are reelected or not is how the economy performs in the 12 months before the election. In 2012, Barack Obama faced unemployment of 7.7%. That's pretty high. That's the highest, in fact, ever faced by a president who didn't outright lose. But the American economy created more than 1 million new jobs in the 12 months before the election. The direction was positive, not strongly positive, but positive. And that just spiced with a heroic mobilization in the black community. 2012 was the only election in American history where black people were more likely to vote than white people. That put him over the top. But, okay, we're now 6 months from the election. The American economy has lost 40 million jobs. We haven't touched bottom yet. We're still losing jobs. And we all hope we'll touch bottom in June and that we will begin to create jobs maybe in July. But there just isn't time for the kind of turnaround that you need to avoid defeat. We're going to have tens of millions of people out of work in November. So I think that bodes ill for the president, aside also from this terrible civic unrest, which he has made so.
And so, David Frum, when we hear Donald Trump talking about getting the economy moving again, ignore the coronavirus, take this fake quack drug, is all that sort of geared towards trying to get those numbers back up? Did we lose David Frum? David, are you there?
Today, we are not merely transferring power from one administration to another, or from one party to another, but we are transferring power from Washington, D.C., and giving it back to you, the people. For many decades, we've enriched foreign industry at the expense of American industry, subsidized the armies of other countries while allowing for the very sad depletion of our military. We've defended other nations' borders while refusing to defend our own. And spent trillions and trillions of dollars overseas while America's infrastructure has fallen into disrepair and decay. From this day forward, a new vision will govern our land. From this day forward, it's going to be only America first. America first. Every decision on trade, on taxes, on immigration, on foreign affairs.
And David Frum, we have you back.
Yes, okay, so
we went to a cut from Donald Trump's inauguration speech where he was talking about America first. I don't know if he was referring towards using the military on Americans first, but that's where we are now.
Well, here's one of the concerns I've had, and this is actually one of the things that made me such a strong anti-Trump voice within the Republican world. America first means America alone, because the deal that America made with the rest of the world at the end of World War II was the United States is the richest and most powerful country on earth. And unlike all predecessor great powers, it would not use its power selfishly, that it would build a system that was good for everybody. And we would trade together in freedom. We would provide collective security. And as a result, America's allies would willingly accept American leadership because they trusted that leadership to be used responsibly. America first means America alone, and America alone means America without partners, and that means no leadership, and that means, and we've seen this through the Trump years, when the United States wants to do anything, it loses the force multiplier of having allies. Why is that so important? Back when I worked for President George W. Bush, the American economy was about three times the size of the Chinese economy. Today, the American economy is only slightly bigger than the Chinese economy. We're running neck and neck, and pretty soon the Chinese economy may be even bigger than the United States. China is too big for the United States to constrain alone. If you want to change the way China behaves, if you want to change the behavior of someone as big and strong as you, you need big and strong friends. You need to mobilize Japan. You need to mobilize the European Union, Great Britain, Australia, Canada. There are lots of partners. India, Vietnam, there are always people who want to work with the United States. But you have to not be a jerk about it. And if you're a jerk, then you discover you're alone. And if you're alone, you're alone with someone as strong as you, and they don't have to listen.
Now, back to the point of the voicemail, the caller sounded very concerned, very worried. You could hear it in the voice about what could happen. What lengths could Donald Trump go to hang on to power, even to things that we would consider beyond the norm?
Well, here he's got a couple of moments after the people vote. On the first Tuesday in November, there's a long period in which the vote is finalized. And that is a real moment of danger. Between the time the people vote and the time in the middle of December when the Electoral College meets and formally certifies a winner. Remember, see, under the Constitution, that's the election when the Electoral College meets. Everything else is advice, theoretically, to the Electoral College. So between that first Tuesday in November and the meeting of the Electoral College in the middle of December, there is possibility for a lot of mischief, to dispute results, to deny them, to try to mobilize public opinion in some way, to throw things into chaos and confusion. Once the Electoral College meets and certifies a winner, and if that winner is not Donald Trump, then now the clock is ticking, because the date of the inauguration is in the Constitution. If Trump loses the Electoral College in the middle of December, on the appointed day in January, he ceases to be president. It doesn't matter whether he leaves the White House voluntarily or not. He's just not president anymore. And, you know, the guy with the nuclear box, he walks away and goes to President Biden. It's not a feasible thing. The danger is between mid-December and the end of January, what does Trump do to the legal system of the United States? Does he pardon all of his criminal associates? Does he direct enormous amounts of public money to himself? Does he try to pardon himself and test whether that's legal? We don't know the answer to that question. It's never happened before. We've never had a president needed. With Richard Nixon, we did. He was pardoned by his successor. But Trump may try to pardon himself. There's lots of possibility for chaos, and we'll do all of this in the course of a very sick economy and a very sick country.
So should we be preparing for these events, and how? Should we be talking about that we have to prepare the American people to stand up for our democracy?
Yeah. I think we, in fact, are doing exactly that. I think there is a great national discussion, and you're seeing these debates over mail-in ballots to educate people that the things that Donald Trump is going to try to tell you are not going to be true. And we had an example of this just the other day. The president yesterday unleashed tear gas and clubs on peaceful protesters at Lafayette Square. And he said, when he was explaining why he did this, he said these protesters had defaced monuments. They defaced the Lincoln Memorial. They defaced the World War II Memorial. As it happened, I, with my two young daughters, had been at all over Central Washington in the 2.5 hours just before we left around 5 o'clock. The violence was unleashed on the protesters at 6:30. We went to the Lincoln Memorial. That was our route. We went to the World War II Memorial. And it was true that at some distance from the Lincoln Memorial, one of the placards that advertised our some jerk had taken out a can of spray paint and sprayed something. And there was some spray paint at some point on the World War II monument. But when the president of the United States says a monument has been vandalized, you think, like, this is more than just clean off some paint. This is real damage. But he lies and lies and lies, and he gets people inflamed. And the service we can all provide in the 6 months is to give people balance and perspective, make them understand what is true and what is not true, and how much of what the president says is not true.
But truth has been is under attack. Truth itself.
Truth itself is under attack. One of the reasons to attack truth is it's not that the people not only think that lies are powerful, but the ability to tell a lie makes the liar powerful. And Donald Trump will again and again constrain. He'll be in a position where he'll have somebody important, the head of the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, the leading epidemiologist in the United States, standing there, and he will say something untrue. And then we all have to watch that person's face and say, how do they cope with this? In any other situation, look, if George W. Bush, when he was president, I mean, he was fanatical about this, but if he'd been standing with Dr. Fauci, who had the same job then and now, and President Bush had said something about viruses that wasn't right, Dr. Fauci would have turned to him and said, Mr. President, may I add something to that? And Bush would have said, go please, Dr. Fauci, go ahead.
And so we see the liar's dividend, where the lie isn't just the lie, but it also is just the erosion of what we think is actually in front of our very eyes. We're taking a break. You can call in. We're going to get to these callers when we come back. 833-877-8255. The source continues. Listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. With me on the line, David Frum, staff writer at The Atlantic and author of Trumpocalypse, Restoring American Democracy. We invite you into the conversation. Our number is 833-877-8255. You really want to hear what you got to say. 833-TPR-TALK. Let's go to Michael. And Michael, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you so much for taking my call. Mr. Frum, I wanted to ask you, do you see a change in the very definition of conservatism these days, especially with Donald Trump, but also with the Conservative Party in Britain and so on? whereby it's becoming more of a populism and isolationism in not only trade, but in other matters of international cooperation? And if so, will American conservatives fight this? Because I have a feeling that a lot of them don't agree with Donald Trump on a lot of these, like trade issues, for example.
All right. Thank you for that question, David Frum. I mean, it sounds like we're going to the conservative movement that we had in the 1930s.
We have definitely seen from 2010 to 2020 a rise in xenophobic, anti-trade, anti-cooperation movements all over the world. And I talked about this in my first book, Trumpocracy. Sometimes these movements look right-wing, as they do in the United States and Great Britain. Sometimes they look left-wing, like the present president of Mexico, who's a lifelong figure of the left, but he also is anti-trade. He also is anti-international cooperation. By the way, he's a huge sucker for quack medicine. He's been very bad on pandemic preparedness. He opposes face masks. He promotes quack drugs. In many ways, he has a Trump similarity, even though his own historical background is on the left. And I think a lot of this came out of the pain of the Great Recession of 2010. What this pandemic is teaching our generation is the same thing that the Great Depression and World War II taught our parents and grandparents. The world is too big to look inward. The world is too small to look inward, and the United States is just too big to be apart from the rest of the world. So we are going to have to rediscover, facing a global pandemic, we need a global response, and we haven't had one, and we're all suffering worse because of it. It would be better if we had been able to cooperate effectively. You know, President Trump has rightly criticized the World Health Organization for its not being fast on the job in China. And that's been a real problem with the World Health Organization. He's not the first person to notice that. President Bush and President Obama before him noticed it. And they built an independent American eyes and ears inside China. They're Americans at the Chinese equivalent of the Centers for Disease Control. They're Americans at the Chinese equivalent of the Department of Agriculture. There are Americans attached to local governments in China. And there were American reporters from independent news organizations moving around China as best they could. It's not a free country. And reporting on what they saw. And in Donald Trump turned up those eyes and ears. He began to withdraw those people from China. And he looked away when the Chinese began expelling the American press. Trump, who calls the free press the enemy of the people, he was quiet. He didn't do anything about it. And so we were left blind. And when we were blind, so everybody else depended on those Americans. So the British, the Europeans, the Japanese, they all depended on that American presence in China to tell them what was really going on when the World Health Organization would not.
Shouldn't a true conservative be thinking about maintaining status quo, that it would be better to protect American industry and our jobs and everything that we've got have built up in the United States by doing the smart stuff, making sure we don't have a global pandemic?
Yeah. The United States has been running. Donald Trump had a message of American failure, that America was not the country it had been, not the country it should be. I think one of the things that we needed to do a little bit more was stand up for the accomplishments of the United States and this extraordinary world we built, where things were much safer and more secure, and there was so much more prosperity. But we have real problems, and we have to address those. And one of the most important problems, and maybe talking to a Texas audience, it's worth stressing this, is how progress has been concentrated on the coasts and in the great cities, and the non-metropolitan areas are being left farther and farther behind. Donald Trump didn't change that, but he benefited from that. And if we are going to protect the country from episodes like this, we have to make sure that rural America does better economically. Meanwhile, rural America has unjust amounts of political power because there aren't very many people living there, and yet the system systematically privileges the voting power of people who live in the less populous parts of the country. So we need to rebalance the economy in favor of non-metropolitan America and rebalance the political system in favor of the unfairly treated cities and coasts.
An email from Joanne. What does it say about our society that there are still 30-40% of American people who support Trump and his policies, such as taking children from their parents at the border and ridiculing people with disabilities? You could go on, but you get the idea. I mean, Trump still has a base.
Yeah, but the people who vote for him are not all the base. First, look, this is a two-party system, and the parties are very strong. One of the things I often point out is 1932, when the bottom of the Great Depression, Americans were literally going hungry. Herbert Hoover got 38% of the vote. For all kinds of reasons, people stuck with the party of their parents and their grandparents. So don't assume when you see that Donald Trump is at 42 or 43%, or maybe now he's a little lower, that those people all love him. Many of them are just people who are, you know, they're culturally conservative. They're with the Republicans, and they don't even maybe follow politics altogether closely. The people who are really with him are maybe half that Republican vote, which is disturbing enough. But I think one of the things we all have to do is learn to forgive each other as Americans and to not harbor negative judgments about huge numbers of other people who live somewhat differently from you. And that's the ending of Trumpocalypse. As I talk about how I'm all in favor of holding Trump and the Trump family to account for any crimes they may have committed in presidency or beforehand. And I certainly have limitless scorn for people in the Republican world and the conservative media complex who, knowing the truth, have told lies. But the great number of Trump supporters, they're our compatriots. And we need to work together as one people. And their interests and their concerns should matter to people on the other side of the political divide. The other way around should be true too. That one of the things that has been so upsetting is about Donald Trump as president is he doesn't see himself as president of the whole country. I have this joke, but it's not a joke, where he sees his job as being president of the white people of the red states of America. We need a president who is president for everybody, including the people who voted against him.
Let's go to Simon on the phones. Simon, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Thank you for allowing me into the echo chamber. You know, I've noticed that NPR programs like yours invite conservatives that echo the exact same views that you may have of Trump. I was originally going to defend Trump on his numerous achievements in the economy and in foreign policy, but I was told I only have 20 seconds before I did cut off.
No, you have take all the time you want. You go for it.
Okay, great. Unfortunately, your guest has transformed Trump into a distorted caricature, delusional fantasy he obsesses over. He talks about, some of the things that are just lies that came out of his mouth.
Okay, give me some examples. Listening.
I don't have a litany. I mean, he's been speaking for 40 minutes. But let me get to his Trump's achievements. First of all, we are no longer the world's policemen. Our men and women do not die on other countries for reasons of other to benefit other countries. NATO members are told to pay their fair share. He has eliminated tension with North Korea. We were very close to actual war. He has defeated ISIS. He has pointed out that the press, yes, the media, lies, and that is thoroughly documented. He has improved the economy tremendously, whereas with Bush and the Democrats, both Republicans and Democrats, they were trashing the economy, giving away, signing treaties that were absolutely horrific for our country.
Like which one?
He has ended the foreign oil dependence. We are now the world's foremost exporter of oil. And as for these fantasies that the Russian were controlling him, that...
Okay, I'm going to have to give you a wrap up, so I think you've got a lot of time. One last little... Want to put a button on it? Go for it.
Oh, that's it.
Okay.
I'm just wondering if he's even listening to the crap that comes out of his mouth. It's just lie after lie.
You're getting really nasty now, Simon. So that's not fair. So I'm gonna let you go. Thanks for calling in. Anyone else who wants to engage in this way, we're all for it. So thanks for calling in. So we have 2 minutes here before we go to break. David Frum, I don't want to get into a debate, but go ahead and respond.
I just want to that all the so-called facts are not facts. I mean, the caller is mixed up about things. For example, the United States is not the world's top exporter of oil. The United States is the world's top producer of oil, and it became such under President Obama back half a decade ago, but we remain not a big producer because we're a big exporter because we're a big consumer. So if your defense is predicated on things that aren't true, it is not true that there's been a substantial reduction of military casualties under President Trump. They're running at about the same rate as they were running in the last 3 years of President Obama. And it is just staggering that you would say that Donald Trump has rebuilt the American economy when we have a level of unemployment you have to go back to the Great Depression to find.
American soldiers, are they still dying on foreign soil?
In about the same numbers as they were in the last 3 years of President Obama. Low numbers, thank goodness, compared to some other times. But if you're going to say it's an accomplishment that you have dismantled NATO, I don't agree. It is true that Donald Trump has weakened America's military alliances. He's weakened its commitment to foreign partners. He did betray the Kurds. If those are you regard those as accomplishments, you are free to do so. But
and North Korea, real quickly, North Korea is that an accomplishment?
North Korea's nuclear arsenal is larger and more sophisticated than it was when Donald Trump came to power. They have continued to test. He just got made a fool of. And everyone except him knows that. Every expert on North Korea except the president knows that.
All right, we're taking another break. Our phone line is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. We welcome all opinions, all callers. Come on in here and state your case. If you think we're being unfair to Donald Trump, let us know it, okay? But right now, we're talking with David Frum, and he wrote the book Trumpocalypse. We'll be right back. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. David Frum is with us. He is the author of Trumpocalypse, Restoring American Democracy. He's a frequent contributor on cable news. He has spoken truth to power for many, many years. He was excoriated by the conservative movement for a column he wrote called Waterloo, telling them that there was no way, no how, that the Affordable Care Act will ever be repealed, and he was proven correct. Now let's go back to the phone lines. 833-877-8255 with Billy. And Billy, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, sir. You go right ahead.
Okay, I just want to make a couple points. Just because we have a two-party system, it doesn't mean you have to vote with your party every election. I mean, there's nothing wrong with good old-fashioned conservatism. But when conservatives have a complete and utter disregard for truth, morality, facts, science, it's no longer a viable party. And me, as a former Republican, I can vote Democrat when it's appropriate. Everybody seems to think everything is so politicized now that if you're not on this side or that side, you have to vote this way or that way, whatever. Sometimes it's okay to jump to the other side if they factor in right and wrong. I mean, the Republicans, like, where are the statesmen in this party? Mitch, Romney is the only one. He's the only one that had the balls to stand up at the impeachment. Everybody else is selling their soul to the devil. It's unbelievable what these people are turning their heads on. And then there's nothing patriotic about supporting Trump. Okay. Every one of his policies undermines everything we're supposed to be about. And if you want to make this country great, again, then install the tax rates that from 1930 to 1980 that were in place that were like 75% average,
right,
that led to a vibrant middle class.
Billy, thank you for the call. Made a lot of good points there. But David Frum, where are the Republican lawmakers in the Senate who could have put Trump in check?
We don't tend to send heroes to the U.S. Senate. And I salute Mitt Romney. He did a remarkable thing. I think we will remember him. Donald Trump tweeted after Mitt Romney's vote that Mitt Romney was not president. And I tweeted in reply. I tweeted an image of the giant statue of Daniel Webster here in Washington. I said Daniel Webster was never president either, but we built a bigger statue to him than we did to Millard Fillmore.
And so, David Frum, what has to happen to correct these things? You write that Donald Trump was able to walk through an unlocked door. He was able to seize the appeal of Americans who felt they had been forgotten by Washington, D.C. And now we got him as president. And how do we fix things. Say if Joe Biden gets elected president, say the Democrats take control of the Senate, there's an opportunity here. They got a couple of years maybe to make some changes. What should they do? Number one.
Well, the most important thing to do to rebuild our two-party system is to take away from Republicans the option of competing for power by disenfranchising voters. In a democracy, people vote. And just have confidence that there are conservative-minded voters. So I have an agenda for making American democracy stronger one of the things we need is a new Voting Rights Act that will replace the sections that were struck down by the Supreme Court in 2013 and that have allowed many states to do things that before 2013 would have been quite illegal, that with the view of preventing poor people, black people, brown people from voting. And unfortunately, Republicans have gone along with that because it's easier than coming up with ideas to win those voters. Just stop them from voting.
So there are people in the Republican Party who feel like democracy is no longer important to them. It's a means to obtain power, but if you can circumvent it, then you should.
Yeah.
I'm thinking about the book Democracy in Chains by Nancy McLean. It writes about James Buchanan, not the president, but an orchestrator. He's written the playbook on how to do that.
Look, we have seen American democracy ebbs and flows, and we've seen periods where the right to vote expands and periods where the right to vote contracts. And since 2010, we've been in a period where the right to vote is contracted. I'll remind you that it was President George W. Bush in 2005 who signed the last reauthorization of the Voting Rights Act, but that act is gone, or substantially gone. In 2019, the Supreme Court approved partisan gerrymanders as legal, but in the United States, partisan gerrymanders always mean racial gerrymanders because there's so much overlap between party and race. And you get the spread out of the old Confederacy into places like Wisconsin and Michigan of radically unequal voting systems. In Wisconsin right now, in the last election, 2018, Republicans got about 45% of the vote. In Wisconsin, they now hold 64 of 99 seats in the Wisconsin legislature with 45% of the vote. That's not right.
So people are going to be listening, like the caller we had, Simon, accusing us of being in the echo chamber and attacking President Trump unfairly. And I understand why he might think that. He's a Trump true believer. But really where I'm coming from here is not to be partisan, but to try to get democracy as strong as it possibly can. That means giving as many people, many citizens in the United States, a voice. And having a choice, but we don't have popular sovereignty in the United States. And conservatives say that wasn't what our founders wanted.
Well, that may not have been what our founders wanted all that while ago, but there has been since then a 14th, 15th Amendment. We've given the votes to women. We've given the votes to 18-year-olds. We've given the vote to the District of Columbia. And I think most Americans imagine they live in a democracy. When people say to them, it's not a democracy, I think Americans say, I thought it was, and if it's not, it should be.
And a Voting Rights Act, is that being talked about? I mean, are we hearing that in the political conversations of what we should do if there is a change of power in D.C.?
You're hearing it from the Voting Rights Act is still on the books. What the Supreme Court did, and this was not crazy, the Supreme Court struck down sections of the Voting Rights Act that said the Department of Justice will give special scrutiny to states and areas where there was a history of bad voting behavior in the past.
Including
the
Texas.
The Supreme Court said that's irrational. And they're right, because under the 65 Act, Hawaii was under special scrutiny and Wisconsin was not. But Hawaii is today, in the 21st century, a very good actor on Voting Rights Act, and Wisconsin is the worst north of the Mason-Dixon line. So the Supreme Court said you can have the Voting Rights Act is on the book, but the special scrutiny has to be based on something that isn't historical, something related to the conditions of today. Well, I think they're right about that. So the law's still there. We just need to amend it to answer this objection raised by the court. It was a good objection, even if the effect was bad, the intention was good. So, yeah, let's bring this into the 21st century and not have special scrutiny according to your voting practices in 1895, but your voting practices right now.
If we're able to restore those parts, Section 2 and other parts of the Voting Rights Act, and will America return to the center?
I think we will begin to return to the center once Republicans understand you have to compete for every vote. the option of simply disqualifying people or finding ways to prevent them from voting or making the votes count so dramatically unequally, that option is gone. So you know what? There are a lot of non-white people in America who own businesses. There are a lot of people of different sexual orientations who feel they're overtaxed. There are people who who are private sector oriented from all kinds of backgrounds. And, you know, the day will come when you're going to, you know, I think the future looks like is you've got a black family. If there's a sister who owns a business and a brother who's a vice principal, why are they voting the same way? They've got, you know, the private sector person might vote one way and the public sector person vote another way within the same family, because we have stopped denying them their vote and we stopped treating them like lesser people.
I got one last caller, Armando. Armando, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Yes. Are we, with everything that's been spoken, how about the global picture when it comes to the impact of, you know, the cyber issues? How is that going to affect our democracy? How is that going to be an ongoing issue? Is that something?
Okay, Armando, so we didn't talk about Russia interfering in our elections, and they have a vested interest in trying to maintain Donald Trump's election, apparently. How is that playing in here?
I'm very mindful of the international context, of the loss of American leadership, and of the need to build a new, stable world around the gigantic fact of China's rise to power. China is now almost as big, almost as wealthy as the United States. It's going to be a different world. And if we want to make it a world of free trade, of collective security, of American leadership, we have to take into account the rise of China. And that means more partnership, more international cooperation. The United States is no longer big enough to do this job all by itself.
I mean, it used to be that Republicans and Democrats, we all wanted the same things. It was kind of like how we wanted to get there. We wanted our children to be educated, have opportunities, have good jobs. We wanted peace and prosperity, and we wanted to spread respect for human rights around the world. How were we going to do that? And that's not there anymore, it seems like. You know, how do we get back there?
Well, we're playing our part right now, this afternoon, in this conversation. I think it's millions of people tugging on the rope. You know, there's this line early in the Trump presidency where people would tweet at each other after some outrage, LOL, nothing matters. And my answer to that was everything matters. It's just there's a lot of everything. And everything you do, every impulse you have, every thought you have, every time you share good information on Facebook and refrain from sharing bad information, you're playing your part. And there are hundreds of millions of us, and we all have to do this together.
And for in 30 seconds, give me something to hope for.
I think we're going to come through because, as Abraham Lincoln promised, you can't fool all of the people all of the time. The individual's foolish, the species is wise, as Edmund Burke said. And I think we're going to pull ourselves out of this.
But it's going to be a fight.
It's always a fight. If it came easy, it wouldn't be important.
David Frum, staff writer for The Atlantic, author of Trumpocalypse, Restoring American Democracy. David, thank you so much for joining us and speaking to the listeners of The Source.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Thanks for tuning us in.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies, produced by Kim Johnson and Dallas Williams, with production assistance provided by me, Ruben Garcia. Dan Katz is TPR's news director. Support for The Source comes from contributors to the Community Engagement Fund, including the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.